And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Well, looks like the old Usher House is history. But that's the way it goes in the cursed neighborhood. Just between you and me, the Ushers always couldn't take a good curse. All they did is whine and cry about it. Not like the McMahons down the way. They turn into goats at age 21. And they never fuss about it. And they make some great cheese. Or the slink stacks across the road. They bleed out from the eyes if they ever hear a certain cursed organ chord on a church organ. Do they wet their pants? No, they stay away from churches and wear earplugs. See these teeth? Yeah. Those are from a gypsy curse 5 generations ago. And we just changed the family motto to, less teeth to brush. Anyway, judge for yourself because tonight's film is House of Usher from the late Roger Corman. And if you don't like it, I curse your whole family to congenital genital warts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am your co-host this evening, Mr. Luke Giaconetti. I would like to thank everyone for downloading and listening to the show today, but I'm not in this house by myself. No, I have several callers with me tonight, sitting in the armchair with his lyre. It's Two True Freaks OG, Chris Honeywell.
I insist that you announce me.
I just did.
Oh, thanks.
No problem. And you heard him there, and in the chaise with a snifter of brandy, it's hair metal hero Chris Tyler.
Did you know that I could hear the scratching of her fingernails on the casket lid?
And then, finally, accosting the chambermaid, my brother, Mr. Jason Giaconetti.
I suggest you leave, Mr. Winthrop. No! Then perish with us.
Yes, and the line that I had, the one that I, especially if you know the background of the individual who says this, any sort of food more exotic than the most pallid mash is unendurable to my taste buds. You
know? Yes.
So we are taking a look back, set your wayback machine to 1960. We are taking a look at what is known in this country as House of Usher, but known elsewhere in the world as The Fall of the House of Usher, produced and directed by a gentleman who just recently passed away. As we're recording this, it was just a little over a month ago, of course, legendary filmmaker, genre filmmaker, and filmmaker of all stripes, Roger Corman. Passed away actually on Mother's Day 2024. I'm just going to leave it at this. Roger Corman's filmography is so large that it's so large that Wikipedia breaks it down more than any other filmmaker on the site. Right? It crosses so many years and so many credits and so many, what he's credited as. Right, whether it's director, producer, writer, you know, some semblance, that some combination therein, even appearing as an actor, right? He has, I dare say, there are few directors, few filmmakers that have meant as much to especially genre cinema in this country as Roger Corman. And so when Mr. Corman passed away, we discussed it here and we said we really wanted to do a Corman picture, and this was the one that I suggested because, as we'll talk about here, the fall of the House of Usher is kind of the coming out party, so to speak, for Roger Corman as not just a guy that made cheapy schlock, instead making cheap but not schlock, right? And that's kind of the important thing here with this cycle of films from AIP, of which The Fall of the House of Usher is the first. And, you know, Jay, you always say there's a great story that Corman told when he was talking to Samuel Z. Arkoff about how kind of how this movie, the genesis of how this movie got made.
Yeah. So he said to Arkoff was the head of AIP Pictures, for those who don't know that. What he said to him was, he goes, instead of me making two like $50,000 movies or $20,000 movie, whatever it was, right, kind of thing, why don't I make that are kind of, you know, cheaply made, black and white, you know, that are nothing spectacular. Why don't I make one big one for $100,000 kind of thing? And that's literally how he sold this to him. He goes, look, he goes, we could take, and he was looking, because they were looking at Edgar Allan Poe material, because they could get that readily available. They were able to purchase those, the rights to that.
Not to interrupt, but all the Poe, yeah. We talked about this several years ago when we did the Colorado Space, which was adapted from the H.P. Lovecraft story. Edgar Allan Poe's works by 1960, public domain. That means that you can use them freely, which, you know, what's cheaper than a cheap license? Free.
Free. No right? license. Yeah.
Free is for me.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is they were looking at what they could do, because they were looking at, like, was it Hawthorne and, like, whatever. They were looking at other, like, what could they adapt? And Poe lends itself so well to, again, it doesn't have to, it could be his you know, the poetry, it could be short stories, it could be anything. All that stuff lend itself so well to genre pictures because he wrote about, you know, things that were dead and things that were echo bump in the night and whatever. And what happened was Corman knew that he could keep making, you know, little cheapies, right? He could go on a long weekend to, like, wherever, film, you know, Attack of the Crab Monsters and stuff like that. He could film all these cheap little movies and keep making them. But if he ever was going to be able to get a chance to do it, so he took a chance. And as we know in life, sometimes you take a chance and it doesn't work, and sometimes you take a chance and it hits real big. Well, this one happened to hit big. They made 8 Edgar Allan Poe movies between 1960 and 1965, Fall of the House of Usher being the first. And the success this movie had allowed them to see that, yes, Corman was onto something. If I make a movie in color that, you know, and Vincent Price was in now, I think Vincent Price and I don't know exactly how many times him and Corman worked together. I can find that. But what you wound up happening was, is you had, you know, Vincent Price, who was, again, a bankable actor by way of genre pictures. I mean, he wasn't Cary Grant or Clark Gable or whatever, but he had already by the 1930 what year? When was Tower of London? 32, 31. He's in Tower of London with Basil Rathbone and Boris Karloff, right? And so he's there, and he had been in movies. He's in one of the Three Musketeer movies. He's in all kinds of stuff. But you started having Vincent Price became a bankable name to put in a movie that was of the more spooky kind of thing, and people knew who he was. That Vincent Price for this movie literally stayed out of the sun, changed his diet to make himself look more emaciated, dyed his hair blonde, shaved off his mustache. I mean, that's a lot for a guy who was known for having black hair, a black mustache, and that's who he was, you know, kind of thing. So,
well, Price is in 7 of the 8 Poe cycle films, yep. Right? There's one, I think it's The Premature Burial he's not in, which is the one with Ray Milland. I'll forever love Ray Milland just for Frogs, but that's a whole other can of worms that we're not going to get into right now. But
exactly.
Some of those frogs, the Descendants, still hopping around South Florida, you know, so, you know, reach out to Dr. Bill Robinson and ask him about that. But anyway, get the stunt frog. But the thing with Price, okay, because you're right, by this point Price had been well established doing genre films, but he had also done, like, real movies. I always think of, like, Laura, right? From 1944. And of course, the Ten Commandments, which he is, it is amazing because I was watching this with my kids today. And when we first see Roderick and he talks, my husband goes, I know his voice from something. It's like, that's the master builder from the Ten Commandments, you know? It's like, oh my God, you know, he's such a recognizable screen presence. But the thing with Price.
I thought they were going to say Thriller.
I said that too. I said he did the rap in Thriller, but we watch the Ten Commandments every year on Easter, right? So that is a bit that they are well acquainted with. Yeah. But the thing with Price is that if you look throughout his career, no matter what it was, what type of movie it was, whether you're talking like House of Wax or The Fly, you know, House on Haunted Hill, The Tingler, Witchfinder General, you know, Dr. Fibes, Theater of Blood, you know, any of these things, he's, even if he's hamming it up, he's all in, right?
He does not phone stuff in.
That's right. I love him, but this is no Charles Bronson. Okay, you know, we're done. 5 o'clock, I'm out of here. You know, that kind of thing. It's like
he was prolific, and that usually, like, lends itself to really having some clunkers where you're not into the movie set or whatever, if you're doing a million movies. And, you know, he's been in bad movies, but he it usually wasn't because of his performance for lack of him trying.
I mean, he was freaking fantastic even on Batman.
Yeah.
As Egghead. It's like first off, as an aside, you know, they say that a lot about on Batman 66, but Vincent Price looks like, they said, we want you to play a character named Egghead, and you could just knew he was going to have the time of his life doing this.
Yes.
Right?
Real quick. So the film was shot in 15 days, and it was his, at the time, this was Roger Corman's longest film to date. It was shot for under $300,000. Just to give you an idea.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a ton of sets and stuff like that, but I'm saying, we had talked money a second ago, but yeah, shot in 15 days, which is insane because you can't even shoot a commercial in 15 days nowadays. And then it was at the time his longest running film, which he then made movies longer. And it was under 300,000. I'm trying to get what he called.
Right. And that 300,000, what I've read is that 100,000 of it went to Price.
Yep.
Right. And what that money allowed them to do was to build those sets, right? And to do the special effects to the point that the fire is reused in several of the later post-cycle movies as stock footage.
That's the problem.
I get that, but here, right? Yeah. You made the investment here, and then you use it again and again. But the ability, and what's amazing in this film, first off, it starts with an overture.
Yes, that's my first note.
Yeah, well, it's right there at the front, right? So you know that, to me, it's like the overture, that means important movie in 1960, right? If they have an overture, it's not just some B picture, it must be an A picture, right?
Yeah.
And then what are the first, they say, you know, it's Samuel Z. Arkoff and I forget the other credit there, I'm blanking on the other guy's name, that were presenting it. Right. But then the first two things it says in CinemaScope and color.
Yep.
So they put them right up front that it's like, oh, this is not just, again, some cheapy B picture. It's in CinemaScope and color. That means something. So before we even get the title, they're giving you and they're pushing it out to you there. Right. So and they don't put, of all the names in the opening credits, who's not there? Roger Corman. Roger Corman's name doesn't appear. He's the first name to appear in the end credits.
Yep.
Right. So it's all about changing the expectations of the audience, which is what this ended up doing for AIP, because I think the writing was kind of on the wall by 1960. It's like, hey, you know, we made some good money doing these cheapies, but it's like audience tastes are changing.
Yep.
Right. And so if you look at the 60s for AIP, besides the Poe series, what's the other big series that's a moneymaker for AIP in the 60s? It's the beach party movies.
Yep.
Right? So again, chasing a different market in color, you know, going in a, you know, not necessarily, you know, tackling still what you might consider a genre film, right? Insofar as it's a teen movie or a musical, however you want to, you know, not just going for straight money, but still exploitative in its own way, but different to cater to the tastes of the audience. And both of those series made a bunch of money for AIP.
Well, the thing is, remember, Corman made a bunch of biker movies too prior, like kind of thing that were.
Yeah, well, that's right.
That was a genre into itself. Like there, that's a genre he later came back to. You know, we would see show up in later movies, you know, kind of thing as you get down the road with him. But like making genre movies was some studios wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. They were like, we're not doing this. We're going to make epics. We're going to make whatever. But at the end of the day, AIP as an independent was able to survive by making the movies that filled the drive-ins. You needed movies you needed stuff on the screen. You needed 67-minute long running movies that would play so they could sell their popcorn and they could sell their sodas, they could sell their hot dogs. You could do two in a thing. You needed that, and that's what it was. And a lot of those double features, I talk about all the time on Bots, Bugs, and Babes. We talk about a movie, I'm like, and this was played on a double feature with whatever. And it's like, when you went to see I Was a Teenage Werewolf, it played on a double feature with The Hideous Sun Demon. They didn't play together. I'm making it up, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, but that's what you would have. And you would, they're date movies. Right, kind of thing. You would go, the guys would go with their girl and they'd have whatever, and it's a date, and you go to the drive-in. And it was one of those things, you needed stuff. You were not showing like the big roadshow epics that you would have to send away to get tickets for. Dad talks about that all the time. To go see certain movies, you sent away for tickets. Tickets would come in the mail. It came with a giant book that like talked about the movie. And that's when you would go to like Radio City Music Hall. And you would go see whatever, you know, this big epic movie. Well, that is AIP was not making Spartacus.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
No, Mr. Sardonicus. That's quite a bit. Right. That was Castle. That wasn't even AIP.
but William Castle's in the same vein, right? It was about making, because if you're not making the big epic movie, that's your big movie you put in every year, you had to make the other movies that filled in everything else because there was a call, there was a need for it. And in life, you know, some people are always like, well, I got to be, what? Sometimes you got to be the guy who's filling the need, because you're filling the need. You're making, it sound crazy, but you're making a good living. You're going to work forever. I mean, that's how you got to make so many movies. If you, right. Like I was saying, Roger Corman's filmography is longer than probably anyone else's ever. Like, I don't know anybody else who did as much, as had his fingers in as many different pies, so to speak, as Roger Corman.
Started so many careers.
Like, oh my God.
So many careers. If anybody ever sees a copy of How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime.
Yeah.
By Roger Corman. It's not one of those introspective autobiographies. He's talking dollars and cents
right
through the whole movie, and he just basically tells how he wrangled some of the most horrible crap that you know he would have someone make into always making money. You know, he was I know this is a crap movie. I gave the guy 4 days to film on the sets from this last movie, but look, it made 300 times its budget. You know, because its budget was nothing.
Right. And Corman's ability to recognize talent too. Yeah. Because the story I think of is you mentioning, you know, filming on a different set. That's Dementia 13, right? Yeah. And Dementia 13, for those that don't know, Francis Ford Coppola's first movie. Because Ford Coppola, I believe, was a production assistant for Corman, and they had shot a film, and he said they had a couple of days left with the where they had shot it. He goes, I've got a picture I want to shoot. And Corman said, go for it. Because he knew that, he said, I knew Coppola could pull it off at least well enough that we could release it, right?
And the thing is, and that's what he said, he would give people a chance, and none of the people, it's not like any of them were like, look, this is a young director I found. They're all working on the set. They're all working somehow. They're either working on as a script writer. They're working as a production assistant. Some of them are carpenters, for Christ's sake. Like, they literally are working and doing things on the set. And because he would hire people and they were like, look, I have an idea. Great, let's hear it. And he would listen. How many people in his position would say, who cares, and blow them off? But he would always listen because you never knew where the next picture that might cost you 20 grand but makes 150 is coming from.
Yeah. You know? And he didn't just give him a start. He gave him guidance and like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
He would tell that like hardcore mechanical, they'd be like, how am I going to film this in a week? You know? And he would tell them, he would say, do this. You're going to have to cut this corner out. You're going to have to do this really shitty and cheesy, but you know, if you focus on this, it'll make the movie entertaining and blah, blah, blah. And the important part is get it done. And I mean, that stuff, you know, is so,
it sounds like common sense, but it was more helpful
to those people. Yeah. It was more helpful to those people than some esoteric, you know, idea of you. Well, you know, movies are, you know, a gift for the senses. So you have to touch all this.
Yeah,
no,
well,
he was just like, also nuts and bolts too. He was just like, get your lighting guys in there at 6 a.m. and have them doing this while these guys are doing, you know, that sort of stuff. And there were lots of people who had to make crap movies for Roger Corman. But then the second they would see the people who made the crap movies that were like, you know, the Death Race 2000s and stuff. And Paul Bartel would go off to do Eating Raoul and, you know, and stuff like that. And he would recognize it and use it to its full potential. Like if we had to, when he died and we were like, let's pick a Corman movie, my favorite Roger Corman movie, unfortunately, the one I would have wanted to do is in a horror movie. So we can't really do it. You could argue that it's a horror movie because it's a horrific subject, but it was, what was it? The Intruder, the William Shatner.
That's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
That movie,
yeah,
but it is okay. That's
that
not
was
a,
like his big passion project. He was really into that movie, and I remember watching it just getting ready for a Shatner Cheese Fest. It was like, wow, this is well done.
Yeah, no, the problem with The Intruder is that it might be the most horrific movie he's ever made.
Yes,
because of the subject matter.
Yes,
it's. I mean, for those who don't know, I'm not going to spoil it too much. Somebody really racist in the South. Let's just go there. I don't want to give all of it away, but yes, if you haven't seen it, it is a great movie. And if you don't,
Shatner is a con man, racist, race baiter in the South, you know, during the war, it's just horrifying.
And a lot of people didn't know what they were going into when it came out. But it hits way harder than you would think it hits. And you're like, okay, that's crazy. Like, you know, so, but that, again, it might be the most horrific, you know, story-wise, what he's doing, because that's real. You know, ghost castle, or, you know, a guy tied to a table with a pendulum coming down. That ain't happening all the time, but, you know. That kind of other stuff, you know, but
well,
anyway,
you know, that was Samuel Z. Yarkov. One of the things he talked about a lot was that there were certain elements that he wanted in his AIP films. And one of them was fantasy, right? Fantasies that were common to the audience kind of thing. And The Intruder was confrontational. It was the opposite of it, right? It was not, hey, you know, this is something you thought about. Here, we're going to do on screen. It's like, hey, remember, know that crap you don't want to talk about, you know, white audiences from the early 60s? Here you go.
Yeah.
Don't you want to pay money to come see this? And it's like, it's you know,
let me rub it in your face a little bit, you know? Yeah.
As a film, like I said, it's hard to watch. It's really good. But as a commercial object, yes, it was not particularly surprising that it was not a huge hit. Now, on the other hand, The Fall of the House of Usher was a huge hit because in 1960, in the sort of 60, according again to some sources, it made $1 million off the $300,000 budget. And the thing about this film, one of the things that I really like about this film, so I always kind of lump thematically and stylistically the Poe series, the Poe cycle, with Hammer. What Hammer was doing a little bit earlier in the 50s and then into the 60s, right? They were shooting in color. They were doing these gothic stories. They were remaking these old stories, or, you know, adapting these old stories, yep, and doing it period, but like in a modern sort of way as far as how you shot them, how they looked. There was a lot of lush costuming, lush sets, a lot of heaving bosoms type of situation. But what I like about specifically the Fall of the House of Usher is that you look at those Hammer films, they're adaptations of European works. They're set in Europe. They star European characters, right? And European actors. This, yep, is AIP. Edgar Allan Poe is an American author. This is an American story. It takes place somewhere in New England. You're not quite sure, right? Because the short story doesn't tell us, only that, yeah, it's far from Boston. So, but it's in New England somewhere. So these are, yeah, American characters telling an American story. And I really like that for AIP, because it's, you think of the Gothics and we tend to think of Europe. At least I do. I like this American, yeah, Gothic, right? So that's always struck me as neat, because that's, Poe is like the poster child for American Gothic fiction. Yeah. So now we're making an American film about an American Gothic writer. So I always like that. And again, it is in so many ways so perfectly American, right? It's about the push and pull between a young woman who has this very sheltered family life. She goes off and goes to the city and meets some people, and now it's the push and pull between modernity and family tradition. Except that the family tradition is madness, right? It's literal insanity, and it's like, oh man, it's like, you know, and again, Poe is such a, I think as a lot of us, as you know, Americans, when we come up in school, we read a lot of Poe, right? You end up studying Poe in lit class and stuff, especially American lit class, and so you kind of chew the cud a little bit on this, but sometimes you just lose sight. It's like, man, this guy wrote a lot of good crap, right? Yeah. And a lot of stuff, as Jay said, that is right for adaptation. So even though this has some changes to it, it rings true, and Corman just lays it all out here. And the fact that you have this film that has four people in it,
yep,
yeah,
right, it's got four people, it's got a handful of sets, it's got one really trippy dream sequence, it's got a fabulous matte painting of the house.
I said all that stuff off air.
Right,
yeah.
But doesn't, normally a film has four people, you think, oh, it's like a little closed room mystery or something. It's like, no, it's certainly, you know, covers a lot of ground, but it, at the same time, it's economical in the same way, right? You don't have to have a huge cast of characters. In this case, having a small amount of people is the point, right? There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to get away from anyone here, because it's inside the house, and the house itself becomes a crucial character in the film, which is, again, there's a reason I picked this one, because it's always kind of stuck with me as being like, you know, just if this was Corman's coming out party, as, hey, I can make these color widescreen pictures, you know, he kind of hits it out of the park here.
Yeah.
Well, I went into this expecting it to be kind of slow and stodgy, but enjoyable. You know, I was, because I know Corman's a good filmmaker, and I got sucked right in. Like,
I see that dialogue. I said that earlier too.
Dialogue, like in the, if, like, for one, hiring Richard Matheson to write it is always a great idea. He was at his, like, kind of like his height, maybe not the height of his career, but he was in a prime. Oh.
That's right.
When fertile part of his career.
Yeah,
Matheson's writing a lot, and he's always solid and interesting. And the thing about it is that dialogue in the wrong hands could have been really awkward and yeah, stodgy. But with this group of actors, you're with it. It's like watching Shakespeare with not the greatest actors, or watching Shakespeare with great actors. You know, you forget the, you know, you're getting the gist of every line and the emotional heft of what's going on, rather than just hearing this, like, pretty verbose, you know, formal speech. in this one, you know, and lots of close-ups of people doing this dialogue and their eyes and everything, you know, they are all committed to their parts, and it's riveting. It's all the way through.
I was saying off air, I got sucked in as soon as we're opening on Mist and a horse clopping up some grass, and then here's this beautiful matte painting, and I was like, I know where this is going, and I'm ready. Like, you kind of know, even if you've never read the Poe story, you know exactly what kind of movie this is going to be from that first 10 seconds.
So, not to be the guy who's counter to everything, the problem is, if I had never seen the other 7 Poe movies, I probably would enjoy this more. And if I had never read all the other Poe stuff, because Fall of the House of Usher is one of my least favorite Poe.
Yeah, fair enough.
But here's the problem. Like, to me, reading Poe, because we read Fall of the House of Usher, right, in like sixth grade or something, it was just one of my, okay, right? I always liked The Telltale Heart. I liked The Pit and the Pendulum. I liked The Tomb of Ligeia. I liked Mask of Red Death. Like, I liked all those stories more as just someone reading them. So when I saw the movies, like, again, they're adaptations. The problem to me, like, if I was picking one, it's Mask of Red Death. To me, Mask of Red Death is probably the best of the Corman Poe's movies. But that's just me. It's not saying that this one's not good. It's just that if you'd never seen the others, which it sounds like some of you haven't seen. I know Luke's seen them, but you guys might not have seen them. This is where he's starting, but he goes, wait, I know where to take this, because he turned up certain things and turn down other things, because the audience in general, it does not want to see the same picture 3 and 4 and 5 times. They are all very different than each other. And I'm not saying that it's, you know, that, again, whether you like it or not, but to me, when Luke said Fall of the House of Usher, I was like, okay, like, I'll watch it, I like it, but it's not my favorite of all the, if I'm picking one, I'm picking Mask of Red Death. Because to me, that story is so good, and there's twists and turns and all that stuff. But like, by the same token, when you read Pit and the Pendulum, the actual is a short story technically, right? You know, kind of thing, right? The movie's not the short story.
No,
right.
Right. So when you watch the movie, you're like, oh shit, it's not even the same thing. So
there's a pit and a pendulum.
Well, I mean, that's like with The Raven. So after we watched this morning, my youngest was asking me, and I said one of them was The Raven, and she wanted to say, I'm like, honey, it's not like the poem.
Yes. Okay? Yeah.
Not. It's like The Raven is kind of a poster child for what you're saying, because by the time you get to The Raven, it almost becomes like a farce.
Yes.
Right?
The Raven. Yeah, Simpsons actually adapted The Raven more.
I was in 10th grade English. We watched that segment of the Treehouse of Horror when we were doing Poe. And when my oldest boy was doing Poe, we watched that segment of the Treehouse of Horror. And it's still very popular. You know, every now and again, I'll get one of my kids, I take thy beak from out my heart. I form from off my door, you know.
Nevermore.
But that's you had names.
More easier to skip. Like 13th part 1, pretty tame by today's standards. And you want to know something? When Jay and Dad covered Friday the 13th part 1, I had to try so hard not to put that in the email, because it's the absolute truth about that movie.
Okay, but in all fairness, Friday the 13th part 1 is a murder mystery. It's not a slasher movie.
It's a murder mystery that doesn't play fair with the audience.
No, but that's true. Nailed it on the head years ago.
But my dad loved Friday the 13th part 1 because...
Be that as it may.
I just want to say this. Dad loved Friday the 13th part 1 because it's a murder mystery. Right? Kind of thing. And now, like, now they're just slasher movies. Right? He's like, oh, okay. Right? Kind of thing, right? But he loved the first one, right? Because he was like, it was really good. It was a murder mystery. And I'm like, I know. But we know who's killing everybody. Once you know who the killer is, things kind of make sense, but not really. Okay. But anyway, the whole idea, though, is once you got to the later ones, the Raven, the name the Raven, people knew the story of the, like, the Edgar Allan Poe poem. Oh my God, I know that. It is literally, like, there's a raven in the movie. That's about all that movie has to do with this.
Yeah.
But the thing is, by that point, people knew, oh, Corman's putting out, AIP is putting out a Roger Corman movie that's based on Poe. I've liked all the other ones. I'm going to see this one. And it's not that the Raven is bad, but, like, it's not, but if you're going and expecting the Raven, you're not getting that. You're getting wizards and, like, magic and shit, right? Kind of thing, which is kind of crazy if you think about it, because, like, the stuff you get, like, because he's much more closer to the source material here. This one might be the most, I'm trying to think, this one might be the most, you know, like, true to the source material. I'm trying to remember if there's, Tomb of Ligeia is pretty close. I'm just saying, it's like, but it's one of the things, like, this is really close to the source material.
Right. Yeah.
And, like, well, you know, which one actually? Tales of Terror.
Tales of Terror is the anthology, right?
That has the cast of Amontillado, but they don't call it that. Right. But I forget what they call it. Maybe that's where he walls them up on the wall and stuff like that, right?
I have heard, sir.
So. But I'm saying it's like
on the Vault of Startling Monsters.
I was going to say, now, if you folks, if you want to hear a fantastic rendition of the Cask of Amontillado featuring the late, great Sean Engel and our friend across the pond, our man in the north, Andy Leyland, go back into the archives because that's on one of our Halloween specials. I have heard, sir. I can still hear Sean saying that
line. But, you know, the whole thing was because it took, the Tales of Terror takes the Black Cat, but it also takes parts of a cast of Amontillado.
Oh, and there's a couple others, too, I think.
But it kind of mixes those together, kind of make, like, the one kind of story from it and stuff. But the whole point, by that point, though, like, you knew what you were getting. You knew what you were getting. The same thing Comedy of Terror.
They knew what they were getting into when they bought their tickets. I say let them crash.
I say let them crash. But, you know, anyway.
I do want to say this. So I want to talk about our cast briefly. And I actually want to start with Mark Damon. Okay.
Mark Damon.
Okay. So Mark Damon. Not that Mark Damon. But Mark Damon, who plays Philip Winthrop. Okay, a couple of interesting credits for him. So a couple of years later, 3 years later, he is in one of the segments of the film Black Sabbath by Mario Bava. Now, what's interesting is that he is in the segment The Wordalock, which is the segment that also has Boris Karloff. Now, if you've seen Black Sabbath, you know that Mark Damon plays a guy who rides up to a house at the beginning of the segment and stays there while all sorts of weird crap happens. So it's like, you should have seen this coming. You did this picture already, man. Okay. While you're acting opposite a legendary horror actor.
Yes.
So, the other thing I did find funny, so Mark Damon was actually in The Longest Day. And then a year later, he is in an Italian film, which its name in Italian is Il Giorno Più Corto, but its English release name was The Shortest Day.
Ah.
And The Shortest Day is actually a spoof of The Longest Day.
Oh,
and it had countless people in it. If you go to its Wikipedia page, it's like 6 or 7 page downs for the number of actors and actresses in this, because it is a spoof of the Longest Day. I thought that was funny that he did The Longest Day in 62 and then The Shortest Day in 63. So,
best up and coming actor for House Usher.
Yeah.
He's on screen acting. It's not like you can say, well, you know, he had all these special effects backing him up. Nope, he's on there acting. Yeah. So.
And Chris, you had said there's a lot of close ups. And I got to say, so Vincent Price, who plays Roderick, and Myrna Fahey, who plays Madeline, they have some wonderful face acting in this.
Oh, yeah.
When they're at dinner, the two of them kind of, you know, because because Philip's like, yeah, this is some good palate mash you guys cooked up here. You know, this is pretty good stuff. And they're just kind of acting at each other. And it's like, you know, they are very believable as brother and sister who probably spent too much time in this house. Mm. Right. And it's like that kind of weird relationship that they have. Price, of course, you know, was a little legend. Fahey, she's more known for doing television. She did some, she actually started out doing like beauty pageants and that sort of stuff. But she did, and she did a few pictures, but she mostly did television. So she appeared pretty, you know, she was on The Adventures of Superman and Gunsmoke and Zorro and, you know, just did a lot of those types of shows through the, through into like the mid 70s, right? So she did a lot of that type of TV work. So she worked steadily, but she's very good in this. And, you know, she again embodies kind of the, her role very well, because you feel for Madeline, but then in the last reel, it's like, right? You know, yeah. not to, full spoilers here. It's like, was she crazy and her brother chained her up in the casket, or did her brother chaining her up in the casket make her crazy? Because I can tell you that my youngest, she was convinced. She goes, nope, she was normal. Then her brother locked her up and she went nuts trying to get out of it. I'm like, okay, that's her take. Right? Yeah. But it's reasonable to go either way here. And I like that it's purposefully vague, right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously she and her brother are teetering on the edge. You know, I mean, there's a whole conversation about, you know, that there's obviously mental illness in their family to some extent.
You think?
So, you know, and you know, that they know that, like, even if you're not a total psychopath all through your life, there's going to be some point where you break, where you crack, you know, and they're all on the edge of cracking most of the time, you know. And so it's one of those things where it could have gone either way. It kind of really doesn't matter, because it's just, you know.
No, I mean, you're about to be an usurer or a mass murderer or a blackmailer or a harlot. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. Or she was going to get married to this guy and, like, then kill the whole family at some point, you know. So, you know, and there's, you know, there's a thing where Vincent Price can be right and wrong at the same time. But that's what makes it horrific, is there's this kind of inevitability to it. And there's a kind of like, was she...
Yeah,
sane or crazy, it doesn't matter.
If she never went home, would it have happened?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And even Philip says that, because you didn't. He's like, you know, you're the one that forced her to live in a graveyard, right? So it's like, but it's like he's doing it for what he feels is his fraternal duty to his sister,
right?
And even that, I love when, because Philip says, he goes, you should get that crack in the wall repaired. He's like, for future generations of ushers, you know? Because he's like, do you think I've not thought of this, sir? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, and the dude's going to bury you and be, you're gonna think he, you know, was wiping your butt with silk at the same time. Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, he's just, you know, the whole time, though, he just, yeah, as you're watching this, again, it depends on your take on whether she's crazy or not, or whatever kind of thing. Or is he just, because he's just completely insane, or is he literally just, does he know more than everyone else? It's just, when you're watching it, it's one of those things that, because things are, you know, kind of left up to your interpretation, two different people sitting watching the same thing at the same time can get two very different things out of it, which is... you know, I always find that interesting when you're watching a movie, especially this, because there's only the four people. Like, there's not like there's a whole lot of other characters you got to worry about. Like, there's just, it's there. It's right in front of you. So I just want to throw this out there. I know we were talking about Myrna Fahey. I just wanted to throw this out there real quick, because I was looking up something, because I wondered why I'd never heard of her beyond that. She passed away at the age of 40 from cancer. But I was just looking through this fee. This caught my eye. Became the subject of death threats while dating Joe DiMaggio in 1964. The FBI determined that the threats came from a patient at the Agnew Mental Hospital in San Francisco, who could not bear who could not bear to see DiMaggio with anyone other than Marilyn Monroe, who died in 62.
Oh, no.
Oh, Christ.
Like, wow. Like, I understand. Like, I'm, where again, I'm,
well, he was in a mental hospital. So.
That's what I want to know.
So, I know, yeah. It just going to get things like...
And that's especially something if once you, you know, put that together with the fact that DiMaggio was one of the shooters at Dallas in 63, right?
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, that's a different story.
Everybody knows this because the Kennedys had Marilyn Monroe killed. DiMaggio was one of the shooters that may have shot Kennedy, right? Because there was like four or five of them out there.
Yeah. Well... Anyway, so just to tie,
maybe it's just me. I don't know. You know.
Just to tie this together, Myrna Fahey, again, as Luke said, was on many different TV shows, including Batman, where she played Blaze in whatever episode. It'd be really funny if she was on an Egghead episode as Blaze. That'd be really funny. But I didn't say they were, so I can't say if anything that ties it together. That'd just be like just that little knowing nod. They could look at each other. And, like, only people who had seen House Usher would know, you know.
Yeah, it'd be funny if you played, like, Egghead's sister.
That would be even funnier, yeah.
And that'd be excellent.
I'm trying to think of, like, a female name that could rhyme with, like, yolk or something, right?
Yolk.
Jesus.
Yolklanda. I don't know.
Sister Yolklanda.
It would have been something like Egwina or something.
Egwina! She's queen of the yolks. We all got yolks, I guess. Anyway.
So apparently she plays Blaze is a character in the two episodes featuring False Face.
Oh.
Which a lot of people remember because they actually put False Face in the original
mark.
Yeah. Question mark. That's right. So that, ooh, you know, scary. Scary. Scary.
Oh my God. Anyway.
Like I said, I mean, as the first one in the series, this was the one I was leaning towards, and I was glad. I say this a lot with these older films. I was glad to have an excuse to rewatch it, because to me it still really holds up. And again, the opinions vary on the story. I know more people probably like that kind of fall in the same camp as my brother that don't really care for the False House of Usher compared to. Like Mask of the Red Death, that's the one I always love. I read the Mask of the Red Death as a Halloween segment on this podcast, so you know obviously I enjoyed that one. And then who knew we would actually all start living the Mask of the Red Death a few years ago, right? I painted all the rooms in my house. That's all I gotta say, right?
So there were a lot of internet articles that were just like sitting through the pandemic. Why not watch the Mask of Red Death? yeah, why not? The only thing that took me out of this movie was, and this was from childhood, from something my friend Todd Riley said when we were watching some horror movie, is when you see a casket get turned over and a skeleton falls out. Like in this case, it was Miriam, her mother, the casket flies out and the skeleton's there. He would look at it and go like, do they bury people naked all the time? What's going on? Did that person get buried naked? Where's their clothes? They're just a skeleton.
That's how I want to be buried if I get buried.
Yeah.
Well, you also want that full open casket too. Buck ass naked, right?
Yeah.
I was like,
I'm going out the way I came into the world.
All I was going to say,
car crash, we're all having open caskets. Let's make that vow right now.
just pump full of energy drinks and gas station dick pills. I'm good to go. You know, kind of thing. That's how I'm going out.
I'm going, die as I lived, right? But you know what? If you go full frontal in the casket, I think you've got to make sure that you have it inscribed on your casket. Look upon my works in despair.
Look upon my works, ye mighty,
and
despair.
Oh, boy.
Actually, no, with my sense of humor, it would probably be more like trying not to look at my dick. That would be what would be posted up there.
Well, I'm a little shy about my dick, so I'm going to have them put a Pringles can over it just to...
Well, we were watching Panther, or you could put a beer, you know?
Oh my God.
All right, we're talking about dick pills now. All right, let's get this back on track.
That was a shot in the dark, Luke.
Oh!
It's like that song by Ozzy Osbourne. You know that one.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But the thing, like I said, with this is that I also like this, that it was interesting watching this, because I watched this with my oldest boy and my youngest daughter. And the oldest boy was like, you know, he's like, I read the Full House of Usher, I'll watch this, right? He'll use you up for anything. But my daughter's like, well, is this one we can watch? Because a lot of times, you know, I don't let him watch the stuff we watch from the vault. And I said, yeah. I said, you can totally watch this. And it was funny because, you know, she's 11, right? So by the last act, she was starting, she's like, oh no, don't go in there, man, you know? Doorknob, don't go in there, right? You know? And so she was really getting into it. And like I said, she had her opinion straight up that obviously the brother was wrong, because there's no way a younger sister could ever do anything wrong, right? A younger sister only has other push her into doing bad things, you know.
Well, they also really leaned into her being normal, but just a little ditzy. Not ditzy, but just, you know, a little kind of naive and that. So there was never any like tell that she could, you know, start foaming at the mouth at any time.
And I tell you what, when she goes crazy, go nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, you can always tell in the eyes, right? You know?
Yeah.
And she is. Oh, and she
was good with her eyes, and they went in on it in the camera angles and the. I mean, it's such a. There's so many things that maybe they weren't as much a cliche then, but they still, you know, like a low angle shot of someone with bloody hands, leering up towards the camera and stuff. In this, it's totally terrifying. It's not just a standard horror movie shot. It's super creepy, because her eyes are just like glowing and crazed.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's fantastic.
She goes from zero to fuck you real fast.
Yes.
It's always the crazy ones. Am I right, boys? Am I right? You know.
Oh yes. God. So. Hang on, I was trying to. So, Fall of the House Usher, Vincent Price. I'm trying to see which collection it's in.
Yeah.
Let me see which collection, because the Vincent Price collection is here. So, this came out on DVD with Pit and the Pendulum, originally for Midnight Movies.
That was part of that MGM Midnight Movies double feature collection.
I have all of them downstairs on the shelf.
Let me just interject this before you continue. Man, if there were some of those you didn't pick up at the time, Godspeed to you, sir, because some of those can get very pricey on the secondary market, because they seemed like they were going to be around forever, and no, they were not. So,
okay, so I got it. It's the Vincent Price collection. It just says the Vincent Price collection, so it's got to be the first volume. This one features Pit and the Pendulum, The Abominable Dr. Fives, The Haunted Palace, Fall of the House of Usher, Mask of the Red Death, and Witchfinder General. That's from Shout Factory on Amazon.
That's a good collection.
$37 on Amazon for those. I mean, good Lord, what a! And they're double sided disc. Oh, there says disc one, disc two. So it must be double sided. Yeah, they're double sided disc. I have this set collection, but like, literally, these are all bangers right here. Every one of them in here. The Haunted Palace is that Lovecraft?
Yes. So the Haunted Palace is a little bit odd in that it is actually a Lovecraft story, that because Corman, Jay, you already said Corman wanted to try and get out of the formula of some of these Poe films. And so he went and got a Lovecraft story, right? He got The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, which is a novella, right? But AIP said, oh, not so fast, Raj. And they slapped a Poe title, The Haunted Palace, onto this Lovecraft story.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, Pit in the Pendulum, we talked about the Abdominal of Dr. Fibes. I mean, that's just a great one. The thing about Fibes, and I've always said this, Fibes and
Theater of Blood?
The Theater of Blood literally are like, they are so akin to each other. And that some people think they've seen Theater of Blood when they start, like, I've seen this movie, and then they only seen Fives or vice versa. But I love both those movies. They're different enough, but they still have the same underlying pinnings that make them feel like they are related to each other. And of course, you can't go wrong. Mask of the Red Death is on here. And then Witchfinder General. If you've never seen Witchfinder
General. Witchfinder General.
Shit. You know, kind of thing. So, but there are several Vincent Price collections that have been made available. The second one, this is the third one. The third one, I'm trying to think what's on this one. Third one was Master of the World, Tower of London from 62, Diary of a Madman, Cry of the Banshee, and then where's number two? Where's number
second two? Ozzy Osbourne song based movie.
Yeah. I'm not seeing volume two here yet, but you were able to now get movies, and these are movies that for a long time you were not able to see. If you didn't, like Luke said, if you didn't score the Midnight Madness, you know,
double
two
features,
movies,
yeah.
Double features, these movies were out of stuff. You couldn't get them. They just were not there. Now, there's certain ones like The Tingler and things like that have always been kind of available, but like there are movies that were just, you just couldn't see. They weren't available. Now it's streaming, everything else. You have a lot more options to you. But for a long time,
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned The Tingler. I'm on that same Amazon page. I've got a different, it's not, it's an import, but it's a double feature of The Tingler and The Mad Magician.
Yes.
Which I think Jay knows where I'm going with this. I always remember The Mad Magician being on, was it Channel 11? Mm-hmm. Where they were showing it in 3D, and you had to go to 7-Eleven and get the 3D glasses for it. Such a distinct memory of that, of specifically The Mad Magician, not realizing it. Hey, this is basically just House of Wax, right? Yeah. But it's but I'll always remember that because getting Mom to take us to the 7-Eleven in Danbury to get those 3D glasses so we could watch.
We didn't have a 7-Eleven in my town, so you had to go to the PNC market.
We had to go to another state.
Yeah,
Jesus.
We literally had to go across the border to Connecticut, you know?
Yeah, it's not that far, but yeah. Okay, so the Vincent Price Collection, Volume 1, is like $37. Volume 3 is like, whatever, $40. Volume 2 is $200. Holy shit.
Jesus.
Good job, Shout Factory.
Good job. And that one's got House on Haunted Hill, Return of the Fly, Comedy of Terrors, The Raven, Last Man on Earth, Tomb of Ligeia, and Dr. Fives Rises Again. Well, the problem is, Last Man on Earth and House on a Hill, you can get from like a million other places.
Last Man on Earth is public domain for some reason.
Isn't House on Haunted Hill public domain also?
Probably, I think so.
But it has the other Fives movie.
Yes, that
right,
is,
that's the problem.
That's the problem right there. It's got the other Fives.
Anyway, long story short, so if you're interested in getting these, they're available. The volume one is the one. I mean, if you're going to get one of them, get volume one. There's just all of those. There's eight bangers right on there, seven bangers right on there. They're all good. You'll enjoy them. And if you've never seen Fives, if you've never seen Theater of Blood, you should see that too. But like, if you've never seen Fives, you are in for a treat because you want to see Vincent Price. Yeah. While still being menacing, Vincent Price at times, literally in Theater of Blood. He has to have some very witty lines. Let's put it that way. Try to say this, you know, kind of thing. Because there's something that
he gets to indulge himself. He was a very popular. Yeah. You know, well-educated, well-spoken, and a well-traveled gentleman, a well-heeled individual, and he gets to have fun on set, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you would like to, if you've never seen 1960s House of Usher, you are in luck. It is available included with Amazon Prime. Now, what's interesting is that if you go on Prime Video and you search for The Fall of the House of Usher, there are a couple of choices for this film. One of them is included with Prime. The other ones they want you to rent. And they're all the same running time. The only thing that was weird about the one that I watched, because I have this film on VHS.
So I watched the it on Prime just because I was watching on the big TV, and which is a smart TV. That the only thing that was odd is that on my VHS copy and other copies I've seen, there was an Overture title card.
Yeah,
it just said Overture, like it normally would with an Overture title card. The one on Prime Video is simply a blank screen while it plays the Overture. It includes the Overture, but it doesn't say Overture, right? So I guess they assume that, you know, you get it. There's music playing. Go get your snacks. Go to the bathroom. Do what you got to do because, you know, our movie's getting started here, right? You know, so that's about it. But if you do want to see it, it is available for streaming, included with Prime Video. No, I didn't find it on any other streaming services for like included, but it is also available to rent or buy digitally if you prefer to go that route. If you're one of those folks that doesn't like physical media.
Okay, not to tangent off in a different direction, but okay, modern TVs. Do any of you guys have, I'm assuming you probably do, have a VCR hooked up to your latest TV?
I do not.
Yes, I do.
When we moved into this new house, it came with a VCR, a bit like I've got like a 40-inch Samsung, you know, modern TV, and a VHS player.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, baby, I'm back with physical media nowadays with the current thing. So I've started picking up DVDs and VHSs, you know, more DVDs and VHSs. But if I see something really juicy on VHS, I'll pick it up on the off chance that I might, that either because I want to watch it or I might be able to sell it on eBay. So I picked up Monty Python, Life of Brian. And when I was hooking up, and I'm using this TV as my computer monitor, so I'm setting up my whole setup, and that's where I am now today, in my own vault in the basement. I was like, I'll pop in, you know, I always always can watch Life of Brian, and it's one of those things where you can just watch it like watching a couple sketches from Monty Python or whatever. And I was like, oh, I wonder what a VHS tape is gonna look like on my modern TV. And it looks like it was shot on video. And I don't know why that is. It strips all, maybe it's a setting on my TV. Yeah,
it probably is. There's a lot of stuff that will reduce judder, and it uses AI to smooth images.
Yes, exactly. Hiro just said it.
And it does make everything look like video.
Yeah, a lot of times that's called either motion smoothing or image smoothing, depending on which brand of television you have. So it's a very similar thing. Some of the earlier LCD TVs that first had this technology, I remember watching Captain America: The First Avenger at one of my wife's friend's house, and it was like making me like physically ill.
Yes,
because it wasn't moving naturally. And I'm like, what is wrong with this? It's like my eyes are not.
The TV's fixing it.
Right. We're uncanny valleying ourselves, right?
Yes. So yes.
That would be the one I would look for because I have a DVD VCR combo unit that's hooked up to my 60-inch Hisense, and it plays VHS and it looks normal, right?
Okay.
So now that may also be that I have a Hisense, which is a lower on the you know, totem pole as far as the high-end TVs go, right? No, I don't have like a Sony or one of those, so maybe less technology in it.
You should definitely be able to turn that setting off. If it's a Samsung, hit your menu, go to video, and you can turn everything off. You can turn off the judder reduction, you can turn off the motion smoothing, you can turn all of it completely off.
If there's any TV manufacturers out there,
it might be fun to watch like Star Wars and watch Star Wars shot on video, you know.
Yeah, it's called the holiday special.
Yeah, what? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It makes your the whole trilogy into the holiday special. That's how great our technology. Those are the summits of technology that we've reached. That we could make The Empire Strikes Back look like the holiday special.
Well, my package of Blu-rays that I ordered, I got a whole bunch of stuff from this company. And what I picked up was called the Grindhouse Edition of the original trilogy. It's the original trilogy taken from actual film negatives.
Yes.
And they didn't go through and clean anything up. It's just how it actually looks.
Yes.
They put it on, and Kelly goes, why does it look like we're watching a movie in a movie theater? I go, because you're supposed to watch this on the biggest screen possible, and it'll look like it did in 19... And she's like, so it's not all cleaned up? I go, no, this is literally the movie, how it looked in the 70s. And, the, you know, like, so when Luke and I saw, you know, Return of the Jedi, that's what the disc looks like. It looks like it did when we were in Lake George watching this in this little podunk theater. So, just crazy stuff. Anyway, but I just want to throw this out there real quick. Just want to, as a side, anytime we get Vincent Price, I always mention this. Vincent Price, as people, some people might know, he had a, I would say an assistant who would be with him. And he would walk around the set for certain sets, and he would look at things, and he would point at things. And then, like, those items at times would disappear from the set, especially when they were done shooting. He'd reappear at his house. So that was part of he would pick out pieces of furniture.
Man after
or
my
things.
Own heart.
What I'm saying is, like, that's how much attaché he had on the set. People are like, because he was going with, like, he would just kind of point. And he just would walk around. And it's funny because, I forgot who was telling the story. It's one of the actresses that worked with him on one of these things. And she goes, he would just walk around and just point at this and point at that. And then magically, as soon as we finished filming, it was gone. Like, they
He's
took
like
it off.
He's like a movie serial killer. He has to have a memento of everything to go back on.
Think about that. He acted in a lot of, like, these you know, gothic kind of, like, movies, right? With these beautiful furniture, Victorian style, whatever.
Yeah.
That's what his house is decorated in. So it makes perfect sense.
Yes, and I will say, if you ever get an opportunity to read one of the cookbooks that Vincent Price and his wife, Mary Price,
they're good cookbooks.
They're fantastic cookbooks.
They're some of the best cookbooks you can get, actually, really. They're renowned cookbooks.
Legit shoot, okay, for Mother's Day this year, out of their book, A Treasury of Great Recipes, I made my wife the pâtes de crème chocolat, which are the little individual chocolate mousses, and they were amazing, okay? They were fan-frigging-tastic. But beyond that, they show a lot of pictures of their house, because they were huge and well-known in Hollywood for entertaining for years and years. They'd always have dinner parties and stuff because both of them were such good cooks and loved food so much. They would always love to entertain. So, yes, there are lots of pictures of their home, and it's each room is decorated in its own unique fashion, you know? So there's
these are the Corman years. This is the Michael Jackson room.
I will say this. Actually, Great Recipes has a whole section on hot dogs. Ooh. Because one something again that they were both Dodgers fans. So there's a whole section about talking about Chavez Ravine, right? Where and going out to Dodger Stadium. And so he wrote a thing about, you know, when one is at the ballpark, one must take their hot dog plain as delivered. But in the kitchen of your home, you have other options. And he gives other ways to make hot dogs. And it's like, holy crap, I'm going to make some Vincent Price hot dogs.
Yeah. So
it's hot.
I think I got to do the same thing.
Summer right now, baby. You know.
I was just thinking, there's probably a lot of mentions of Michael Jackson rooms in police reports throughout the country. speaking of props, I wonder what happened to those portraits from this movie. I would love to know where
they're. I'm sure the artist who painted them probably wanted them back.
Maybe, but sometimes, you know, I mean, it was a Corman production. It could. But I often see paintings in movies and wonder where that ended up, you know, because. Boy, those would be some great paintings on your wall. Those creepy Usher faces.
Oh yeah, oh for sure. And they're weird.
I'm gonna look it up on the internet, and it's gonna turn out that the singer Usher has all of them hanging up on his wall.
Actually, you know, my oldest daughter did say that. It's like, oh, like the singer. I'm like, no, honey. The Fall of the House of Usher.
Let's hope
not. Like the singer.
Let's hope not for both their sakes.
Now we're way off the rails. Is there anything else we can add to this? I mean, it's
and I promise everybody, I'm going to fight all the temptation to put it put an Usher song.
I was going to message you that earlier. You need to put an Usher song at the end of this.
So the only thing I will add is that if you haven't checked this out, please go check it out, because it is really quite wonderful, and it's a lot of fun. And, you know, Vincent Price is great in it. The whole cast is great. It looks wonderful. And, you know, you can say if you're your spouse who doesn't like horror movies, like, what are you watching? What is this crap? They're like, hey, it's culture.
This is culture. This is Poe.
This is culture. You okay? You got a problem with Edgar Allan Poe, you Luddite, you know?
Eh. Mari was sitting and reading The Outsiders the whole time I was watching this, because she had never read it before, so.
Judd Winnick, huh? Okay, cool. Yeah.
No. S.E. Hinton.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book.
Yes, it is.
Very different Outsiders.
Mike W. Barr. I gotcha. Yeah.
So wait, we gotta watch the movie this week, because she's never seen the movie either.
Oh.
So. Big funny boy.
And I said that to her while she was reading it. She's like, yep.
Okay. See, I like to screw with people. It's one of my, who was it? Somebody was saying their kid was reading The Outsiders or something. I said, sweep the leg, Johnny. And they just looked at me. I'm like, what?
He's in it.
Basically the same thing, right? Yeah, I mean, what's the...
Everybody. Well, Macchio's in it. I mean, you know. I like to screw with people, too. People go, Stones or Beatles, and I just dead-eye look them in the face and go, the Animals. Walk away.
Hero's dreaming he was in a Hollywood movie.
I could be.
All right, guys. I can't fight the temptation anymore.
Peace up, A-Town. Yeah. Okay.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
For years, I've haunted the antique shops of Europe, searching for antiques to breathe life into the rooms of my own home. At last, here at the Antique Guild, I've found the largest selection of antiques at frightfully reasonable prices. Arranged in beautiful room settings, antique hunting is no longer an endless search through back alleys and dusty shops. You'll find true value at the Antique Guild, prices that won't scare you.